Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Let's face it, the future is now. We're living in a connected cyber society, and we need to stop ignoring it or pretending that it's not affecting us. Join us as we explore how humanity arrived at this current state of digital reality and what it means to live amongst so much technology and data. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marco Ciappelli. I'm flying solo today. Sean is busy somewhere else around the world. And truth is, I'm never really alone. I feel pretty silly talking to you by myself. There is a guest with me, and I have to thank the Mentor Project because that's how we got in touch with this person. And she's going to tell us an interesting story, maybe two, maybe three. We kind of chat a little bit before start recording, and it's going to fall in between redefining technology and redefining society. But if you have been following us, you know that there is really no difference. It's just depending on which perspective you're using to look at a problem. And if I had to say something, and then I'm going to let Janice Lintz introduce herself, she's a problem solver and self-defined and also defined by others as a change maker. So Janice, welcome to the show. Please introduce yourself and maybe, you know, tell us, why are you a change maker? What made you a change maker?
Well, thank you so much, Marco, and thank you for having me. I'm Janice Lintz, and I'm the CEO of Hearing Access and Innovations. And what started me on a path, I've always been a change maker. I'm someone who, if I see a problem, I look to solve it. It doesn't matter whether it's a big problem or a little problem. I want to get things correct and figure out a solution to the problem. So it could be a banking problem, it could be a healthcare issue, or it could be a dramatic global problem, which is what I'm working on with hearing access.
Let's talk about that to start. Why are you involved with this specific topic, the hearing access? What's your origin story? We were talking about superpower before. What's your origin story to use your power to resolve this problem?
My daughter has a hearing loss. So when she was diagnosed at age 2.5, the doctor said there were special schools for her. And I hadn't even wrapped my head around the diagnosis, and suddenly the bar was lowered for the rest of her life. I had no interest in the quality of school that the doctor considered special. My idea of special was very different. My daughter ultimately went to a top girls' school in New York City, an Ivy League undergraduate, and now she's in a graduate school at an Ivy League university. But I don't think that's what the doctor meant. And so I decided that it was easier to change the world than to lower my standards. And it never occurred to me I couldn't do this. And so there was no point in my mind that I ever thought this was not possible. And so I set upon figuring out how to fix what to me seemed like an absolute mess. The information wasn't available. Things were broken, didn't work. People didn't know what access was, so they did nothing. And I decided I had to do research, figure out what it was myself, what my daughter needed, and then figure out why nobody was implementing it. What were the barriers that prevented the access from being implemented? and then figure out who was doing what. If anybody was out there doing something, figure out what they were doing and who was good at what they were doing, because there was no point to replicate or reinvent the wheel if somebody had already figured it out. Sometimes you just have to connect the dots between other change makers. So I had to like understand the whole landscape of the environment that now was part of my life. And so I set upon doing this, and along the way realized it was an absolute mess. There was nobody organizing anything. People were working in silos. No one was communicating. People were fighting over crumbs. And I was like, okay, I need to kind of rebuild and put this together. And that's what I've been doing for 19 years.
It's really amazing. And I'm being kind of sarcastic by saying amazing, because I mean the opposite, not amazing. The fact that for so long, when you look at the past of our society, it's been so much easier to resolve the problem by hiding the problem. Right. So somebody has an issue. Well, OK, there is a special place for that. There is a bucket for that. Instead of working on resolving the issue in a societal way, including and understanding that everybody in a way or in another is different. It's not about the fact that there's a place for you. Your place is here. So what was the problem that you found in this organization that you mentioned? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people wanted to take initiative, but so what was there was missing from making it happen? Was it the technology? Was policy? Was an organization that was going to do that? I mean, what was the main problem?
It was really just an absolute mess. It wasn't one problem. You had one problem where in the United States, people view disabilities as about them versus us as compared to other countries. So that was a huge problem. You had the stigma where people who needed access were afraid or didn't want to ask because they were embarrassed to have a disability. They don't like having a disability, so they just ignored it. So if you don't ask for access, then people think you don't even need it, and it doesn't even exist. That was a huge part of the problem. Then you had the Americans with Disabilities Act that is a federally unfunded mandate with no teeth. So like when we both live in cities where the health department goes to our restaurants and they give them grades, A, B, C, fail. There was nobody doing that for, and still is no one doing that for disability access. So if nobody's grading you and you don't comply, well, then why bother? And wait till you get sued. And likelihood you'll get sued is really not much, because it's so the barriers to suing or filing complaints is so complicated. So even now, after 19 years during this pandemic, I filed a few complaints on access. I wanted to test some waters to understand, because I anticipate testifying about this issue or writing about it. And I wanted to understand the various methodologies. So I actually took one of every topic and tried to see how this works. It is so complicated to do that people don't. Because who wants this as your life? So when you take all of this together, then you also take the ignorance. And I just wrote an article for Harvard Dash Center where I talk about this, where you have access coordinators, when they do exist, they're people using wheelchairs for the most part, because companies want to be able to see the visible disability of the access coordinator so that they can show, look, we've got someone who has a disability doing the access coordinator job, right? So when you say not about us, without us, but the problem is, the perception is that if you have one disability, you are an expert in all disabilities. Well, that's ridiculous, because a person just by happenstance to use a wheelchair does not be an expert. And then people will say, no, they're knowledgeable. No, they're actually not knowledgeable. I have yet to really meet many people. There are some, but the numbers are so small and they're easily identifiable of who they are, because that's how you can count them. they're not knowledgeable. They say they are, but they're also making decisions about another disability. We would never ask one race to make a decision about another race, right? That would be offensive. Like if this is a podcast, made a decision as a white person about how the black race should behave, whatever, any decision, people would be up in arms and calling me a horrible name, right? But yet we ask in the disability world for people to do that all the time. So when you take all of these problems together, you have a mess. And it really became like a rat's nest of problems. And I had to untangle the mess. And I'm still untangling the mess after 19 years. And then take in the last part, which I've just recently figured out, is there are no appropriation code or procurement codes for the access people need. So they're very generic codes. And therefore, people rely on the vendors to make decisions about the access the end user uses. Well, we don't do that for anything else. Vendors sell what's easiest to do and generates the highest profit margin. But yet, if you don't have the proper procurement code or you don't bid correctly with the specific access someone needs in the contract, then you're relying on the vendor. And they're going to do what's cheapest to win the bid. Because if your bid is above, you're going to lose the bid. So when you take, right? So from that perspective, nobody even thought about that. Like when you pass a law, you need to make sure there's a procurement code with the bill. When I've told that to people, they scratched their head and said, I never thought about that. Mm. And like some of this is just actually mind-boggling. Like, how did nobody ever pay attention to these issues? None of the disability organizations, by the way, were even aware of these issues.
Yeah. It makes me think what you just said to the bias in the algorithm, right? When somebody designed technology in a way that it's done by the same kind of people, right? You know, I like to use the example of the white collars back in the days, for example. You know, you don't put yourself in other people's shoes because you don't have those people when you make decisions. So you end up applying the way you look at the world in everything that you do. And I'm not saying you do it on purpose, but at the same time, there is absolutely no diversity concept or inclusion or understanding, as you said, because you can just say, okay, everything that is not normal, given that whatever normal means, it goes in that bucket. It's there is a lot of other buckets in there, a lot of understanding going on. So while you're fighting this this monster, did you find that there was also a technology problem connected with that? I mean, were you asking them to invest a large amount of money in resolving this problem, or was something that, look, it's easy to do it as long as you can wrap your head around it and you make things happen? So technology versus policy, what was the balance there?
It was a combination. Even when the access existed, people didn't want to spend any money. Let's just start with, they didn't want to spend one penny. So
it's hard to do things without not even one penny.
No, they want to spend no money. And then they all claimed we don't have money. And I'm like, well, that's interesting, because the Department of Justice says you have to look at the overall budget, not the money you allocate to disability access. And so when you look at your whole budget, you have to figure out how to implement the access no differently than you figure out how to turn on your electricity, your air conditioning, right? You figure out those. This access is another line item in the budget. And you need to figure that out as well. So I always started with low-hanging fruit. And it's an overused term. But in the beginning days, people didn't even caption their videos. They have at least, thankfully, moved forward from that. Like, that at least has somehow become like, okay, we got that. Because really what happened, I believe, with that is millennials watch captions on everything. The older adults who have since passed away didn't like captions because they viewed it distracting. But the younger generation, who is doing 45 things at one time, loves captions, right? I always see people watching captions now, regardless of hearing loss, because they're watching a movie when they should be working, right? Their partner is sleeping. They're doing a million different things, so they don't want someone to know what they're doing. And you can't wear a headset sometimes, so you watch the captions because nobody knows what you're doing if you're watching. So millennials love captions. So that issue in the beginning, getting people to add the captions was, if sometimes it was just a matter of activating the captions that it existed. Then I had to work on getting them right. So that's easy. Like, how about you just turn on the captions that already exist and put a sign up, right? Okay, I could get them to buy into that. That seemed doable. Or sometimes, you know, because like the History Channel at some museums would supply the videos for free, and they already had the captions, but the museums had no idea. And so that was an easy solution, you know, fixing their, going through and doing an audit of their site and, let's say, with museums and figure out what they did have and getting it on their website. That was also an easy fix. When they started doing that and the people started responding, they realized, okay, maybe there are people out there, because the perception was nobody asked for it because they're tired of being told it doesn't exist and they're exhausted and nobody wants to go around fighting every single time. But when they started adding it and seeing the great response, they realized this was important to add, and they really benefited. Also, a lot of museums, the older adults tend to be the donors. Well, if you can't hear the ask and you don't come to the museum anymore, you're not going to donate. And when you explain it that way, people are like, oh, that's a good idea, right?
Yeah, right.
Right? Like, that's an excellent point. So suddenly this became where people started paying attention. And then I also, because I'm based in New York City, I worked with the major institutions in New York City that had name brand recognition. I realized if I was going to get this done, I had to work with brands that people heard of in little towns. They may not know a little museum in a little town, but if you say you worked with MoMA in New York City or the Met, they knew those museums, or Lincoln Center. And it was easier to leverage the successes working with large and famous institutions. And so that also helped. Plus the fact that I travel extensively. So as I was traveling, I would, at each place I went to, if the access wasn't available, I would follow up with them. And I used to tell people I never go away. So their projects, I'm still on their back about getting done. And it's 15 years later, I'm like, oh yeah, did you add the access yet? So, you know, they know I never go away. And there have been a few instances, like the Intrepid Museum in New York City, when they refused, I went to the Pentagon. And when I won and got, the Pentagon went to the Intrepid and said, if you don't add the access to the space shuttle that we're giving you, we're not going to give you the space shuttle. And right, like, and they flipped out. What do you mean you're not going to give us a space shuttle? This, we're building a whole thing for this. Well, they're like, that's okay. Just add the hearing access. And they had been telling me they couldn't add the induction loops as technology. So they miraculously were able to do it once they were going to lose the space shuttle. But the most important part of that project was, they were so flipped out, they told, the coordinator told all the other museums that I went to the Pentagon. And people realized, oh my God, if this mother could go to the Pentagon and win, right, and get a Pentagon to threaten a space shuttle, this mother is, you know, a force to be reckoned with. Right?
He's like, look, there's only one way you're going to get rid of her. Just give her what she wants.
Yes, that's exactly right.
That's the point.
And it's really funny because the Met, the former director, Philippe de Montebello, had a philosophy. He'd like to get things off his desk. So you just had to keep calling. And I got to know his assistant, Susie, that when I would call, she would say, hi, Janice. And I'm like, hi, Susie, how are you? It's me again. And eventually they added the access because they just wanted me to stop calling all the time. And so they did it. But yes, that is the solution. Just do it.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I mean, it's sad in a way, but it's amazing the example that you're bringing, because if we all have a problem, either in the family or, you know, that's something that you wanted to get done, and we always wait for people to do it. But most of the time, we need to empower ourselves and do it. Because honestly, nobody else is probably going to do it for you.
That's the part that I find, by the way, the most shocking, is that people have this idea, right? They whine, they complain, they it's like preaching to the choir.
Mm-hmm.
And they never seem to do anything about it. I don't whine. If I complain, I actually do something about it. I complain with a solution. And I don't really understand whining, because it seems like a waste of energy.
It is.
But if you're going to complain, complain in a letter with a solution and follow up and let them know you're never going to go away. And you're going to, and you know, when somebody doesn't respond, I start putting in the subject line, third request, fourth request. Usually most people respond by the fourth request.
Right.
When they get past 11, I know they have no intention. And then, so then you have to tighten, you know, the screws a little, and you have to really show them like not going to happen, you know, and you just start doing creative solutions. But if you start writing to someone by the fourth request, they usually respond. They realize
they're not going to let
business.
It go.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm curious to connect the dot with technology. You mentioned the captions, and that's something that has been around for, I don't know, as long as I remember, either you use it or not. And now it's even better because you have it in all translated in all languages and so forth. What other kind of technology have you been able to discuss and bring to the table and maybe even have it implemented? I'm thinking like situation where you can't put caption on it, for example, I don't know, a live theater show or something like that. I mean, is that technology being helping to resolve this as well, or not? And is technology being a barrier or something that will help you to accomplish changes?
Well, first on the captions, you can absolutely do it live. There are different ways of doing it. Most of the time, you know, like for a show, you have maybe not exact words, but you have pretty much a script. And so you can feed that script in and then augment the script, like with a actual live captioner there. And on television, it's pre-programmed, so it's really simple. The difference is now captions are actually spelled correctly. You know, live is a little more tricky, but before, on pre-programmed television, words were splashed across the television set. They were decapitated people's heads. It was just horrible. They were, you know, Bordeaux, the region of France, was spelt like two animals, a boar and a doe on one show. I'm the person who got the caption spelled correctly by coming up with basic process of what captions should look like, you know, where they should be placed, what the spelling, how to do it, indicating music. But in order to reach the entire spectrum of people with hearing loss, you really need a three-pronged approach. Because depending on where you are, you know, yes, you can read things. But if you have residual sound, you want to hear. It's the same way right now I'm wearing a headset, right? I want that sound brought right to my ear. Mm-hmm. So there is something called an induction loop that brings sound electromagnetically to someone's ears or their hearing aids or cochlear implants. Now, that technology had been predominantly in the United States. There have been a few places around the United States that it was sprinkled, but there was no consistency. Nobody understood it. Nobody dealt with it. And I decided to create this thing called the three-prong approach. So just to give you the three prongs, you need auditory, visual, and qualified interpretation anytime there's sound, human or audio. So for example, you would need sign language for people who sign. You need captions, and then you need the induction loop. All three, because depending on where you are, for people who aren't wearing hearing aids or are too don't have residual hearing, they need the captions. They may not know sign language because there are stigmas attached. It's like learning another language. It's not so simple. It's like learning French at age 60. Not so simple. So they're relying on captions. But for people who have residual hearing, they want to hear because it's the same way now we're talking. We're not typing back and forth to each other. It's the flow of communication is richer and faster. So the induction loops I had seen while I traveled, and I didn't understand why they didn't exist really in the United States. And what they do is they bring the sound electromagnetically to your hearing aid, blocking out the sound. And I would see it in taxis in London, in museums. As I travel, I see it in elevators, you know, God forbid an emergency. I have yet to see that in the United States. So what I set up is this.
Sorry, how do you see it? I mean, what does it look like?
So there's an ear symbol with the letter T in the lower right-hand corner. And when, so there's a variety of symbols. If I could, I would recreate the symbols because they're not so clear. But even I knew that was a big project to tackle. So I had to go with what exists. But when you see an ear with a T, that T in the lower right-hand corner says, by you, it would be at the Getty Museum. You would see it. So
I've seen it. I was just wondering, is it an international recognized?
Yes, internationally recognized. And so what the T says, turn your hearing aid or cochlear implant to the telecoil. You don't have to go get a device. If you see an ear with a slash without a T, that says we have some form of hearing access. Good luck figuring it out, right? Because that is just the umbrella symbol, and it's not really clear what that means. If you see an OC, that means open captioned, and that's less important because you would see the captions. If you see CC, that means closed captions. Like on your television, you have to activate the captions. Museums now are using open captions because, again, everything changed. Perceptions about the having captions change. And then the hand symbols, the two hands like showing movement, that's for qualified interpretation.
Right.
I recommend the specific use of symbols because it's much clearer than saying we have some form of access. Good luck figuring it out. Right. Like that means you're now dependent on other people. They don't know what it means. They make mistakes. The specificity is much better.
Sorry. Thank you for explaining that. And I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, my pleasure. No.
I think a lot of people, unfortunately, we may not be educated about that. So
Most people aren't, even with hearing loss. They have no idea. It's not like you get your hearing aids and they give you a glossary. Actually, that would be a good idea. They should give you your hearing aids with I'm going to add that to a project.
Yeah, right? That sounds would be a good thing. What?
Right?
Now that you know, here's a list, a to-do list of what you need to learn, the basic stuff, and how to get around. So you were saying about how involving the museum, involving the city. I know you also work with the city, bringing this at a more general public that needed it.
Yeah, so I worked with multiple places, and right now I'm working with the city of Los Angeles to bring access. I work in my own city. I cannot say the mayor of our city does not view this, in my opinion, as a high priority or has not added the access. And again, it's because the commissioner, in my opinion, uses a wheelchair and he doesn't view this. Somehow he seems to forget it. I don't really understand. Like the access for people who use wheelchairs is permanent, right? You take a ferry, for example, and there's a place to put the wheelchair, the waiting area, there's a place, it's built in. There's no access for people with hearing loss on the ferry. You go to the sound stages in the parks, the wheelchair, the ramps are built in. People with hearing loss, they have to tell you 2 weeks in advance and then they bring the access over. People with physical access don't have to plan in advance. They just get to show up. People with hearing loss have to plan in advance. Nobody wants to plan in advance. They want to be able to just show up, just like you happen to be walking through the park and you hear the music and you go, oh, let's go to a concert, right? Same thing. The commitment from New York City's mayor has been absolutely horrific, and the same for the Commissioner of People with Disabilities. And I've been very outspoken about their, in my opinion, inappropriate handling of hearing access. I cannot say that about Los Angeles. Los Angeles, when I approached Mayor Garcetti, he set up a team to address the problem and said, thank you for bringing this to attention. They set up a team, and I've been working with the Commissioner of People with Disabilities in Los Angeles, Stephen Simon, and he's been an absolute dream. The team has been a dream. And in fact, President of People with Disabilities just wrote a letter to Mayor Garcetti asking for induction loops to be included in all city Los Angeles contracts. That's huge. That is a real ask and a real commitment. And I'm hoping, of course, the mayor will, before he leaves to become ambassador to India, he will sign an agreement doing this. But that is quite unbelievable. you have two. So that's a perfect example. Two cities, two different opinions. And the problem is the burden falls on people with hearing loss and their parents to negotiate this, right? You shouldn't have, access is either effective or it's not. Each city should not be coming up with their own opinion of what effective communication is. And I would love for the Department of Justice to finally come up with some resolution to this, because it's the only way the access is going to be added throughout all 50 states and through every city. It shouldn't be you need to live in certain cities to be able to hear if you have a hearing loss.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was thinking. I mean, the American with Disability Act is from 1990, and it seems counterintuitive for one person, one organization to have to go to talk to every single city.
Right, how insane is that? Right,
I mean, and it's insane.
It's insane. If I don't do it, it doesn't get done. There are little groups that are doing like one-off projects. There's one person running around the country who does churches. Mm. That's great, but like you need a real systematic approach to this, right?
Yeah.
You need this to be and the problem was when you look, if you watch the movie Crip Camp, where they talk about the forming of the ADA, you see that everybody there that was at that crimp camp used wheelchairs. So you can't plan the access correctly. And by the way, the technology has existed since 1978. It's been in taxis in London forever. But it's the same problem we have with infrastructure. There are some Congress members who don't seem to leave the United States who understand how trains move quickly across the country in other countries, right? And ours is going chugga, chugga, chugga. You know, that's crazy.
But if there is a train that goes.
If there is a train, yes, truly, right. I mean, but it's insane. How could you not have high-speed rail in this country?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't. The same mm-hmm. problem with induction loops. If you don't understand it or see it, you can't basically, I mean, when we are all able to travel, I think it's really critical for people to travel to understand the access it is. I mean, I will tell you, the induction loops in taxis, not only is it in London now, it's also in Azerbaijan. And that's how are we falling behind?
And how hard is that to implement?
I mean,
is that expensive? Is it what's again, apart from the political barrier? Is it an economical commitment? Isn't it showing? Isn't like good for whatever brand of taxis or for the metro of New York City, which I know I was reading through your note that you would be working with, or any other company? Like, how the company corporate offices, how do they approach this kind of disabilities? I mean, do you have knowledge about that? I mean, are you more focused on the public structure, or you work with businesses as well?
I work with businesses and I help them. And I, in fact, was just on the phone yesterday with the commissioner of the Taxi and Limousine Commission in New York City because Nissan had, as part of the Taxi of Tomorrow, they were building it in when they built the taxis. But now...
So that's what I was thinking. Can it be implemented in... Look, the car comes with it.
That in this case, in the taxis, it comes with it, but it can be added aftermarket. Mm. We had a car and we brought it to a shop and we wanted my daughter to be able to watch the videos, you know, in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
We added the induction loop with no problem. Mm. It could easily be done aftermarket, but the problem is it's just getting companies to add it. So yesterday I had a call with the commissioner and I'm hoping that will be added, but it takes commitments, not only from commissioners, but getting Uber and Lyft to add it, you know, they're part of the problem. They have fought. They're independent contractors. They don't need to add it. Well, now they're having to have wheelchair accessible cars. They need to also add the induction loops. If somehow you can add wheelchairs, I don't understand why you can't add induction loops. So that was part of having this call and moving this forward, because now in New York City, you don't have to buy the taxi of tomorrow because of a court ruling. So now we need to make sure that induction loops don't fall away and they're incorporated as part of other taxis, and they're also in the out-of-borough taxis. So working on that and working on the same issue with the Los Angeles mayor's office. But this has to be also a commitment by companies like Toyota, Chevrolet, and Ford, that when people buy cars, they should be able to get this like the same way you ask for a convertible roof or a ski rack. You should be able to like tick the box and add an induction loop. And I will say companies like Ford have been not willing to support this and making so much. Toyota dealing with their disability access was a nightmare. They don't really understand it. They don't want to understand it. It's not, if you can build a car, you can figure out induction loops, right? This isn't rocket science. It's very straightforward, but some companies don't want to understand it. And it's really frustrating when, you know, the diversity sadly has just become about race, and the word access has become around physical access. And we need to change the perception that diversity, the D in diversity is for as a reminder for disabilities, and access does just not mean physical access. It's access for all disabilities. Mm-hmm. But when I deal with DEI people, you know, and they don't want to understand hearing access, it's exasperating. Because turn that table around and say to them, I'm curious, if whatever your issue is that puts you here for to be the head of DEI, right? If I said the same thing you're saying to me about your personal agenda, you would be offended. But yeah, you have no problem saying that to me. The perception, and so disabilities are so far behind race issues. I mean, when you think about it, the Civil Rights Act was signed in, what, 1963, 64? The Disability Act was signed 30 years later in 1990. And it's just, it is amazing to me that it's just still so behind. And the perception is, again, it's about them, not about us.
So, I mean, we're going to start closing here, but I'd like to finish with the a little bit maybe of a look into the future based on your experience so far. I mean, I think we all agree that anything that it's inclusive, it has to be referred to every that kind of diversity. And that goes from, you know, anything that you can think from people that have disability in terms of speaking or listening, I mean, or even autistic people that they need a certain space to be able to work. And I think on one side, I'd like to be optimistic and see that society is starting to be a little bit more sensitive about this. On the other hand, I always say, damn it, it's 2021. We should already be way ahead of the game, especially because I think I always look at this with the glasses, with the technology lens on it. And I'm like, we're able to do so much that if we only have the will, there is the technology out there to implement things. So moving forward, what's your expectation about how fast do you think that, and what could we do to make it go faster in order to give this solution to the people that need it?
Oh, I know exactly what I want to see. So if to me, the secret to moving this fast is so simple. AirPods or any of the devices we put in our ear need to add the telecoil to them. Because imagine if you wore an AirPod, right, with a telecoil, and you could go to the theater, let's say Hamilton, which has an induction loop, and you put your AirPods when you see Hamilton, and you can access that induction loop, you would be blown away. Because first off, if you see Hamilton, the best way to see it is with something, either a headset, if you don't wear hearing aids, right, a headset, because it moves so fast, you will miss the language You just can't keep up. It's just so brilliant that if the sound is not over your ears, there's no way you're just going to think it's a nice melody rather than like how brilliant the lyrics are. But imagine if you could go to, if AirPods had this, and anytime you went to a museum, you could hear the sound directly in your AirPods, blocking out the sound of all the people chattering. That would be phenomenal. When that happens, and not just AirPods, but it could be Sony's, it could be every single company, Bose, when that happens, it will change induction loops into universal access the way captions have. And then suddenly induction loops will be omnipresent because everybody will say, oh my God, not only that, but museums can then lower the volume of the videos because a lot of museums, especially in cities where they're trying to form industrial cities where they're trying to create some sort of culture where maybe it didn't exist. And they build these in museums dedicated to whoever lived there. Like, you know, you had Muhammad Ali Center. They're full of multimedia and the sound overload is overwhelming for everybody. Or nobody can hear five videos at one time, right? So if you can then put in your AirPods, hear the video you want to hear and not hear the other videos, that is a game changer. Then they can lower the acoustics within the museum, which will really help people with autism and auditory processing issues and any sensory processing issue. And that is going to be a game changer. But the key is getting manufacturers to understand they need to add a T-coil to their headsets. And they've been reticent because they love using the idea of Bluetooth or proprietary technology because it makes theirs only ours can do this. And so we need to break that lock by having this universal piece that makes every single AirPod or every headset, Bose, everybody add the telecoil. And that is the secret to really dramatic change. And then when it becomes like that, the stigma of people with hearing loss is going to change. So I also think something like AirPods are going to transform and morph into hearing aids. And then, I mean, of course, this is just conjecture in my opinion, but then it'll be like when you buy a car. And instead of when you buy AirPods, it'll be, okay, do you want the basic? Do you want the pro noise canceling? Do you want the hearing aid model? Like adding a ski rack, right? It'll look somewhat similar. And when suddenly you're wearing a hearing aid that looks kind of similar to the non-hearing aid, the stigma is going to be eradicated because no one will know you. It'll no longer matter you're wearing a hearing aid. And I think the younger generation, the way they've become very comfortable wearing with captions, when they need hearing aids, they're just going to like upgrade from the like an AirPod Pro to a hearing aid because they'll be just like, yeah, give me the ski rack version. They're not going to care the way the older generation. They don't have all of these preconceived notions attached to it the way the older generation did. They remember the old big, you know, cones coming into people's ear, Helen Keller with her arms flailing. The younger generation doesn't even know who these people are or the technology. They just don't care. They're like, oh, you need something? You just put it in your ear. Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. And that actually makes me think about how society has been pushing people with disability to hide those disabilities in so that they could feel part of society. I think the trick here is that when you have a disability, you should be welcome in the society with that disability. I mean, you shouldn't be having to hide it, to pretend not to have it. Right? Again, if you're autistic and you're pretending not to be, it's a lot of pain. I mean, I've talked to a lot of autistic people in the industry that, you know, it double the burden for already what you're dealing with. And I feel like any other disability, like, you know, like you have to make the hearing aids almost invisible. Why somebody would judge you because you have that disability? You know, just wear the piece. Right. I mean, I don't know if I'm making sense, but
no. But the problem is some cultures, you see this in some countries, it, because of their history and their culture, they view that people who have a disability, it's because you did something bad in a bad life, a previous life, or your family did something, and that this is some payback. And so there is different cultures with different, you know, basis. And so that's why people are hidden. They don't want to discuss it because it's considered like an embarrassment, which is ridiculous. But I think the tide with this is finally turning. And also, I think people are realizing that people with disabilities have strengths, and that pretty much when you go across the board, I think we've all seen this during the pandemic. We all learned, all of our friends have all different medical issues that we didn't know about, right? Because they can't, they're suddenly more high risk than they, that we knew about. You know, they, I've been amazed. I'm like, wow, you had that. I had no idea. My friends had so many different medical conditions that we're learning about. So we're all learning that we all don't walk between the raindrops and different. And also when you were, you know, people are realizing that when you, you know, people who are autistic are very good at doing repetitive tasks, right? Then maybe other people would find boring, but they don't find it boring. And they see things that other people don't see. And that is a strength.
It's a superpower.
Right. It's truly a superpower, like Greta Thunberg said. So if you start, I think we're shifting to a place where we're looking at what is not your disability, but what is your superpower? We don't really care you have a disability. We're more interested in the superpower. And if you have a superpower, we want to match that superpower to a specific job because you're really good at that. And so when you start looking at superpowers, suddenly disabilities is irrelevant because we only care about the superpower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree. And I want to finish actually just with this because it's a powerful thought. And as I always say at the end of every conversation, I hope that the people that are listening, now they're thinking about this. Maybe we don't have a solution. Although it seems like to me that you're definitely very focused and know what needs to be done. But the people that until now, maybe they haven't thought about it because maybe they don't have relatives or friends with this kind of disability. Now they should walk in someone's shoes maybe for a few miles to understand that if we could as a society come together and welcome everyone and do all we can to make life easy for everyone as much as we can, we will be in a better society altogether. So I love what you're doing. I always hope that technology brings that extra mile to people that are trying to solve the problem. But at the same time, we're human and we can't expect technology to be the solution for everything. Because if there is not the will, and your story for me just is the example of this. You have an easy solution, an easy technology, and you have to fight with your nails and teeth to make it happen because people are not listening to you. So humans are always in the equation, and I hope somebody gets motivated by listening to this story as well.
Well, thank you. I think it's moving in that direction. You know, Bose entered the hearing aid market, Apple's entering, Google. I've approached all three companies to enter the market to disrupt the industry. I think that's good when you have, having five or six companies in a hearing aid industry is not great. It's too insular. You need creativity. And when more companies enter, it's better in the long run. The market will grow. I think people who are not wearing hearing aids because they view it as this old person thing, when the market grows and you bring creativity, people are going to be willing to wear whatever is going to come out as a result. So I think having competition is really fabulous to drive things forward. More people are going to have hearing loss, sadly, because we're all putting things in our ear. Mm-hmm. There's more noise. It's an issue. And I think it's going to change. And I think it is changing. And I'm actually excited being part of that change. And yeah. I think it's actually really satisfying. And if I think one thing, if we've learned from the pandemic, you have to love what you do, because if you don't love what you do, it's really hard to keep doing it when you don't leave your house.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great lesson. And the other lesson, of course, is, as you mentioned, that technology, it's a way to, it's not just fun, it's not just consumerism, it's actually, it's going to augment our capabilities, but also help us to resolve the imperfection that we may have, because we're all imperfect in a way or in another. So Janice, thank you so much for being part of this. And thanks to the Mentor Project for the introduction. And I'm looking forward maybe to have more conversation with you. And you have good news. You can move more mountains here.
Excellent. I look forward to it. And thank you again for having me.
Of course.
BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.